You are listening to the Frula Bros Tech Podcast, episode 255. SpaceX wasn't the only one with a follow-up.
Season 6, episode 255 of the Frula Bros Tech Podcast. Today is August the 14th, 2016. I'm Matthew Dean Furlow, and getting this 100-meter dash going is my brother James Furlow.
Yeah, that's right. The track and field part of the Olympics has started up, huh?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm like, I like the Olympics. I like the Summer Olympics a lot, and I always try to get into the swimming and the gymnastics and everything and get like, yeah, this is really fun and I really enjoy this. But I every time the running's usually the second half of the Olympics. Every time the first time I see sprinters, I just get so jazzed, so much more excited than I have been last week about it. And, we were out on the town because I am on the East Coast right now, mm-hmm. and they were showing Usain Bolt's first qualifying race, and I was just like, we walked into this super packed bar. There was no place to stand, and I'm looking around. All of a sudden, I see the screen. I just stop because I realize he's getting into his blocks, and I was like, Diana, we have to watch this.
Yeah.
we have to watch this now. There's not much time. And so he just stood in the middle of this bar as everybody's like going around, getting in each other's ways, just being in as obnoxiously still as possible for him to run. And it's unreal watching him run. Cause he just like, he
is fast.
Oh my gosh, he's fast. Well, and the best part is Usain Bolt like doesn't like a lot of competitors. They just want to run as fast as they can every single time, you know, and or they want to know exactly how fast they need to run, and they'll think about like, I'm aiming for this pace, I'm aiming for this time so that I can qualify. I don't want to burn myself out going 100%, but they just run and they're. And that's what they do. Whereas Bolt, he gets out of the blocks, and he's in like fourth place. And after like 20 meters, all of a sudden he kicks it into like super high gear for a second, pulls ahead, and then with 15 meters left, he looks over his shoulder at the second place guy, realizes he's going to be in first place, and backs off and slows down so he doesn't get a good time. It's unreal. That's just, nobody does that in sprinting. That's like what a 15-year-old dude would do who's going to go to college, you know, on a scholarship, on, you know, a track scholarship. It's just, it's insane how much faster he is than everybody else. I love it. I love watching him. I love watching it.
Yeah, well, I know he got hurt, too, I think. So because there were questions on whether or not he'd even be able to run in the Olympics, so... maybe that's part of it, but maybe that's also just part of the awesome lure of how fast he is.
Well, that might be, but I know that's always been one of the big things of like, how did he, when he first ran, everybody knows his name now, but when he first ran the 100-meter dash and broke the world record, nobody was expecting it, and it blew everybody's mind. And the reason for that was because he never runs at full speed until you get to like one of these major competitions where it's the final run. And just so happened that Jamaica asked him to do the 100-meter dash like 3 weeks before the Olympics. Nice. And so nobody had ever seen him go full speed before. And all of a sudden he breaks the world record. Not just a little bit, just demolishes it. And jeez, he's so much fun to watch. But everybody is at that speed because you're just so fast. You're like, this is impossible. You people are, oh my gosh, it's great.
You're secretly a gazelle.
Yeah, right.
Admit it.
I know, or at least a car. I could accept that as an answer. Like,
yeah, really. I think a car would have trouble keeping up, to be honest.
Yeah, seriously. Like, a high-performance car. Not my car.
Can't start that fast.
It's the first couple of steps where it's, like, the camera's off angle, and you're, like, watching it as they're, like, coming towards you, so the perspective is all off.
Yeah.
And you can't really see how fast they're going. And, like, you have to watch it a couple times. Did you see them... They're like, as they're driving in, getting up to speed. And it's just, oh, God. And wrapping your head around the sprinters, to me, is, oh, so good. So good. Love the Olympics. Love the sprinting. So much fun.
Yeah.
I wish I was not that slow.
Oh, I know, right? And it's just, yeah, there's something about, you know, here's my attempt to wrap it around. Like, technology is pretty cool and requires a certain level of human ingenuity to pull it off. But it's also one of those, like, let's create the framework and then just kind of let it go. Whereas things like sprinting is like, no, that's just pure human muscle getting after it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's,
it's a different type of impressive and fun to watch.
Right. It's this continual honing day after day, meal after meal, run after run, relentlessness, and then just, yeah, and then just a, just pushing as hard as you possibly can, willing yourself forward in every fiber to do what it's been trained to do, as opposed to, like, building a framework, letting it, the software package does its own thing, which is completely different and completely, like...
It's awesome for a different reason, but it's also... Exactly. You don't tend to get the adrenaline rush.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
maybe with a self-driving car, who knows?
Well, I was going to say, my opening story, I do think there's a bit of this adrenaline rush, but there's actually... Well, you know what? It's James, you know what? We don't want to talk about these boring human endeavors.
Oh,
we want to talk about the sorts of things that I was about to talk about. And so instead of talking about it, I'm going to go through the intro. And because really, what do we do here, James? What do we do? This week, like every week, we'll be talking about the technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, I feel like I skipped something there. It doesn't matter. And the technology they're developing. That's the clutch one, the important part. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yeah. You know what? Sometimes there are benefits to working for the man. So I have right next to me a brand new 27-inch IPS 5K display.
Whoa.
Yep, gonna be awesome. Compliments of my employer, which happens to be HPI, whom I do not represent or hold any of their opinions during this podcast. And
I need to clarify. You got a 27-inch 5K monitor.
Yes. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean... Yeah, that's a really good monitor.
Yeah, so I had one previously, which was only 24 inches, and they just hired a new guy who happens to sit right next to me in the office, and that's the monitor that he got. And so I called up my manager and was like, dude, what the heck? Like, I'm awesome. This guy's a know-nothing. Like, how come he has better stuff than me? And she was like, that's a good point. Order it. I'm like, yes.
Nice.
And so I was like, I can't believe that worked. That's amazing. And so, and I was like, you know, it'd be nice to have the extra screen real estate for my spreadsheets and stuff.
Just that, you know what it is? It's, you gotta be able to, like, you want to be able to put in a spreadsheet with like 7,000 entries and see every single one at the same time. Clear, still clear. Like, it's put them all on the big screen and then zoom it in. You give them the options. Either give me 8K resolution or give me a 40-inch screen. It's up to you.
Yeah, yeah. Either
you
way.
Decide.
Yeah. So I feel like I went right in the middle on that one. And so, yeah. So it's good. So yeah, working for the man. It's nice, but I won't be representing them during this podcast.
Nice. That's, yeah. I mean, I'm a little bit jealous, James. I'm going to be honest.
I'm okay with that.
I'm sitting here staring at a 13-inch screen. It's a very nice 13-inch screen being lent to me by a very nice person, so I will not.
Yeah, but that's also because you're getting the travel for fun, so you don't kick.
That's true. Out loud. I know. I really can't. It's pretty cool. Yeah, so my disclosure is I did it, James. I kept my promise this week.
All right. Which was to not make a decision and see what happens.
Which was, yes, exactly. to now go the opposite direction and be irresponsible about my stock options. So,
excellent.
And by stock options, I mean my options to keep or sell my one share of Skullcandy, which doesn't seem to be worth much anymore because it's being bought by another company. I actually also did for the record, because you chastised me a little bit, and I did do one of those story things on Instagram, where I did, yes, but, so if you want to be able to follow me on Instagram, check that stuff out. I got some cool pictures of the sites that we've been seeing. Like, I got to go to the MIT campus. I also got to go to Harvard. You know, they let me on the grounds. but we, yeah, my Instagram is nextwiggin4, nextwiggin, from the number 4. Also, my Twitter, which is at Matthew D. Furlow. Feel free to shoot me a tweet, and I will look at it and almost certainly respond. But
excellent. So you're putting these on your main Snapchat, or, oh my gosh, when that happened, Instagram feed. You're not actually doing stories.
No, I did do stories.
Oh.
They just go away, so you can't see them anymore.
Oh, okay. So the sidewalk, I guess you would want that Theta Chi one to stay around. Boston.
Exactly.
Red Sox. Who's the tombstone of? I should probably read your thing. Paul Revere. Cool. And then
it's awesome.
You crossed the main state line. Congratulations.
I say that Paul Revere one's really cool because, like, it's the graveyard where a bunch of guys, like Samuel Adams, is there. And
wow.
Which, by the way,
I know those names.
If you think to yourself, Samuel Adams lived in Boston, the beer Samuel Adams has got to be, like, pretty good at the home state, right? You get it fresh. It's got to taste better than it does everywhere else. Yeah, it's just not true.
Oh.
It's, it was, we were a little disappointed. but yeah, so in this graveyard, we walk around looking for Paul Revere's grave because we knew it was there. And there's this, like, this is monument that's probably like 4 feet tall, and it's kind of this cool shape, and it says Paul Revere on it and like a little bit about him. And you're like, oh, that's cool. And then all of a sudden I look down and it's literally like a foot and a half tall. It's this tiny little tombstone. I look at it and it just says Revere's tomb, period. I was like, oh, that's somehow so much cooler because it's just, we're like, you know what? We know who he is. It's good. It doesn't need much. Just a little old tombstone there. And
what are the pennies and coins in front of it represent?
You know, I tried to figure that out. I have no idea, but there's a bunch of your founding fathers' graves have pennies and coins all piled up on them. And I guess people just throw pennies and I don't know.
Here's some more
superstition, James. Exactly. I've been across the galaxy and I've never seen any proof of these superstitions.
Interesting.
Or something like that.
Cool.
I don't know what the quote is.
My week and pictures are not as cool, but I'm James Furlow on the Twitter, which I've mostly just been following Olympic stuff and retweeting that out. I'm also .com and also Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, all the good places, LinkedIn.
Very nice. Very nice. You can also go to our main website for everything we're going to be talking about today. It's furloughbros.com. All the clicks, the links, all the videos, everything's there. It's pretty cool. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter, which is everything I just described to you, delivered to your email. And then there's also our, if you'd like to support, we really appreciate it because we feel like we do this and I don't know where I was going with this sentence. I'm just going to abort and say, support us on Patreon.
Thank you.
It'd be fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. Very cool. So, guess what? We're going to flip rules this week.
Yes, because I don't have one.
You're welcome. So this is your weekly VR update.
Woohoo!
Compliments of me. So, okay, let me see if I can get this right. There was a guy who I think used to work for HP or somehow related to HP in some way. His name is Andre Lee. He is a UX designer and now a VR developer is kind of how that works. So he may not have worked for HP, but if he did and now he's doing awesome things, it's kind of like, aw, great. But anyways, yeah, so he wrote a cool little article that is trying to address the issue with motion sickness. So there's a fundamental problem. It's not fundamental. There's a problem with VR, which is if you start to move around too much or start to like leave the physical room. Okay, so you're in a physical room wearing a headset that puts you into a virtual environment. Okay. As long as your virtual environment is similar to your physical room, no problem. You can interact, you can move, do whatever you want. However, when the virtual environment, when you start to leave it, and there's multiple ways that that can happen, you start to run into problems because your eyes are seeing something different than what your body is physically feeling, and this can tend to bring on some, I don't know what they would call it, simulation sickness, motion sickness. They say it's very similar to like motion sickness that you would get in a car or a boat. I don't know if you experienced them with what when you were doing your thing, but it's a particularly a problem when you're moving around. And so this guy, Andre, he started out with like, okay, how do I solve this problem? Which, you know, is kind of a big problem. So he created a simulation that you can actually get on Steam for free because it's kind of, I don't know, it's a experiment, I guess. He's not trying to sell it. So if you've got a VR set and you got Steam, make it happen. But anyways, he essentially was like, to solve this particular problem, usually what happens is games, they half remove you from the action. Like, a great example is in Eve, he goes, they put you inside of a ship, which part of us, that's the nature of the game. You're inside of a ship, so it works. But it's this idea of you're inside of a ship, and so the ship is the space that you're in. And it's your room, and so you never leave your ship, and so therefore you never leave your room. He says, but you're also just a little bit removed from the action. He goes, and so those are the games that they, or some of the things that they do. Another thing is they'll make it so like you can only move forward, which is like, that's okay. Or they'll put like joysticks or other interface types of items between you and the virtual world, which is something that you've talked about. We're like, oh, it's kind of nice to be able to see that stuff. Part of it, besides like you can see what you're typing or grabbing or whatever, the other thing that it does is it grounds you in reality.
Right.
And he goes, and that, like, it doesn't take much, but that's what you need to do in order
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so he goes, but what I would love to do is be Tony Stark and like fly around in a jetpack, and you know, with the boosters on my hands and everything. And he's like, but that now we're getting rid of some things here. You know, that's the classic. Yeah. You are out in the environment. There is no joystick, and he doesn't want the reference items for you. So he started doing some experimenting. And so the first thing he did was isolate down the variables, which he says there are five of them. The first one is the real world player. That's you. And you can rotate and you can move your head and you can do all sorts of things in the real world. And then there's the real room, Okay. And then there's the virtual camera, which is essentially your virtual head, if you will.
Okay.
And then you have the virtual room, which is the, you know, the rotation or movement of the virtual room, which, by the way, technically the real room has one as well. We just don't really notice it. And then there's the virtual physics, and how that's how the virtual world responds to your actions, such as like thrust and gravity. And technically the real room has real physics as well. Again, it's just a lot more boring. So, so the first thing that he did was he goes, okay, I gotta just like figure out how to fly, and then I'll figure out how to not get sick. this is like, it sounds so awesome. I wish he had video of these, first things where he said, okay, he put, you know, he made an Iron Man suit essentially that had the blasters on the hands, and that's where he put them. And so if you wanted to fly up, you'd put your hands down and press the triggers and, you know, and you take off. He said it was pretty fun where, he could, what was he trying to do? He was trying to, you know, just trying to have it be as realistic as possible where like you were really getting your power from your hands. And he goes, but it was bad. He goes, it was kind of unbalanced and sent me into a ton of mind numbing spins.
Like, oh, it reminds me of like exactly like the opening, like that scene from Iron Man, you know, where he's doing exactly that. He's doing the thrusters for the first time and he's like, and he fires it off and he launches him into the air and he hits his head on the roof. Like,
yes, yeah, exactly. That's funny. And so he's like, he went through all of that. I'm like, oh, that's kind of awesome. The mind-numbing spins, that sounds bad. I could see where you could get into an uncontrollable spin, and you're just like, I got to take this thing off. I'm going to throw up.
Yeah.
By the way, the way he got around that was he said, he cheated, essentially. He says the controllers, they still emit sound and fire, but instead of applying the forces to the hands and creating an unbalanced thrust, he says he literally applied them to the room center of gravity, essentially. And he goes, no more spinning, and I actually feel like I'm still controlling it. So he's like, so win. Boom. What was interesting is he said he then put people into his prototype and tried to see what they were doing, which he said they were able to fly around in a stable manner, no problem. He goes, but once they hit a wall and the physics started to like rotate the virtual room, he goes, even just a little bit, they would feel disoriented. And so he did a lot of like testing with this, and he has a cool, graphic in the article. So I'm going to try really hard to describe it, but essentially, so if you imagine in the real world, like the room or the vehicle that you're in right now, you know which way gravity's heading, okay?
Right.
I know it's probably down. And he says, and that's what's in your real room. And he says, but in the virtual room, a way a lot of them will work is when you start to rotate your head up to look up, it will also rotate the room. And so to your eyes, it looks like because the room rotates, in theory, gravity, your virtual room rotates, your eyes, they see that a virtual gravity should rotate as well.
Right.
And that's where you have a, essentially a discontinuity.
Right. Because the idea being that you feel gravity with your ears, actually. You feel it with the fluid in your inner ear. But your eyes have the, like, what you see, your brain has basically said, like, when I look around the world, I can feel gravity, but I also know where to expect gravity. And so when there's a discontinuity there, because basically what's going on, if like just the, like the root of motion sickness is the your inner ears or some part of your sense of your position, whether it's your inner ears or like whatever, has gotten out of alignment with what your eyes see. And which is why they say like when you're, if you get motion sickness in a car, sit in the front seat. And the reason they do that is that so you can see where the car is going. The problem is when the car is moving left and right and you're in the back seat and your eyes don't see the rest of the world moving. And so he's, and what he's talking about here is like, you're visually expect gravity to be straight, to be associated with it in a certain place in this world. So when it moves in the virtual world, but doesn't move in the real world, like you just said, now you have the discontinuity and we've got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so he said that his solution it's pretty straightforward, actually, was to go, just don't move the virtual world.
you know what you were doing there? Don't do that.
Yeah, pretty much. And so the idea would be, like, for the Iron Man suit type of thing, he's like, if you are looking up, he's like, yeah, you're going to have to keep looking up, essentially, is what it comes down to. It's not going to rotate to make you into alignment. So, because I think it was okay if the world moved up and down and forward and backwards. It was just the rotation of it of some sort was where it would become a problem. And so he's like, so if something's behind you, it will always be behind you. And so he's like, it's obviously not perfect, but he goes, but no one gets sick.
I think what's fascinating about that idea is it's like, you know, we all imagine we want to do the Superman pose or, you know, the Superman pose where your arms, your body is parallel to the ground, your arms are out, right? And you're flying.
Yeah.
And if you were to do that in the virtual world, it'd feel really weird because in the real world, you'd still feel gravity as though you were standing up.
Yep.
Because you are standing up.
Right.
And that discontinuity would be a problem. So what he's saying is, no, we just fly standing up.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah. He's like, if you really want to do that, get a bench or a stool.
Yeah.
Which is exactly actually how they did it originally.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I'm not saying no to that.
but he goes, that solves the problem. He, by the way, just has a super funny gif of a Mercedes-Benz commercial where they were talking about stabilization and they're like dancing chickens around and their bodies are all moving and getting all funny, but their heads stay exactly the same.
Yeah.
He goes, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know,
the follow-up to this commercial you really enjoy, it's Jaguar decided to do a commercial where it's the dude dancing the chicken and there's a literal jaguar sitting right next to it. And it doesn't end well for the chicken.
Nice.
It's pretty funny. That's really good.
Yeah. So, that is pretty good. So again, limitations, like he points out, is like, you can't move upside down. It's hard to bank at extreme 90 degree angles just cause you can't easily do it. But he's like, but you don't get sick, so there's that. He says, again, like the cockpit method and other stuff can also work. So it can just transporting.
I think we'll see a lot of that. I think especially for space travel games, they'll do the old Star Trek method of, no, we have artificial gravity in this spaceship and everything feels like you're sitting on Earth and it'll be great. Even though that makes no sense. You know, so there are certain environments that you can't, that you'll never be able to, well, not never, but you, with this type of technology, you'll never be able to replicate with virtual reality. But, you know, that doesn't mean these games aren't incredibly fun and awesome and, you know, and a big step forward in a lot of ways because, you know, it's interesting. That's good stuff.
That's fun because you're going to have people like this, right? Where he's doing some experimenting, and I know that what we call him, a podcast friend, David Perry, it was kind of pretty sweet. Is friends with Andre, and knows that there's a guy who used to run Tested, who's now doing a VR startup, and they're both on Twitter, and Perry. David saw this article that Andre wrote, tweeted it out to that guy who's starting the VR startup. He was like, you two should really meet. Yeah, it turns out they did and are talking. And then that startup guy actually tweeted David back and was like, hey, thanks for the connection. It was really good. And so it's like, awesome. Yeah, so it's like little things like this where it's like, no, this is not just some, I mean, it started out as a random guy doing some testing, checking out, playing around with it. And it's like, oh, this, these things are, it's probably to some degree is now going to get integrated into at least one virtual reality company that's happening. And if it works, it's going to be a lot like, I can't believe I'm doing this. We're going to talk about this later. The Snapchat stories where it's like, yeah, this is a good idea. We're all going to copy it. And
exactly.
But yeah, anyways, I thought that was pretty cool. Cool story. Cool little learning. And yeah, there's your VR update.
So I wanted to talk about this during the intro. Speaking of things that are like really exciting, technologically speaking,
yeah.
In the same way that I get excited about sprinters, SpaceX, they've landed a rocket,
yeah.
Which at this point is almost, it's right at the cusp of that not being exciting news.
Like you're saying, running, just kind of like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, you keep doing that again and again and again. So like, oh, cool, you launched a rocket and you landed it. Except the big deal here is, no, this is the second time this rocket has done this round trip. So this is the aforementioned, the rocket that they've landed. Checked it up, gave it a once over, refueled it, and put it back out into space. And it was a geosynchronous orbit, so it was one of the really long, hard burns out into the farthest reaches of where we put 10 satellites, and then coming back to Earth. So not only was it a successful launch, which is a huge deal, it was a successful delivery of the satellite, which. Those two things in and of themselves are pretty amazing accomplishments. But yeah, it landed again too. So there'll be, you know, now it's like, how many of these milestones do you, like they're keeping the first rocket that ever landed. Cause that was, you know, for historical purposes. I feel like you should keep this one too though. Right. I mean, this feels like it's even a bigger deal than the first one in some ways. So we'll see what they do with it. They'll probably just start launching them again. These things are actually really expensive, so you can't hold on to all of them for prosperity's sake.
Yeah, but that's the point, right? I love
exactly.
So the link is to the tweet saying, "Oh, we did it," and the third reply is a GIF of Captain Picard clapping.
Nice.
It's almost like a really smug funny. Type of laugh or clap, you know, like just a slow, like, yeah, good job.
Yeah, congratulations. So impressive.
Yeah, I'm just like,
that's really funny.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah,
dude, that's exciting.
I'm going to say it is really exciting. And I think one of the cool parts about it is what actually is more exciting than this is the idea of it becoming mundane. Like there is going to be a period here relatively shortly where this sort of thing won't tweet about it. People won't respond to it. It'll just be what happens. And you know, for a while, it's going to be SpaceX only that will be able to achieve this. I mean, as even though Blue Origin's technically, you know, re-landed a rocket first, successfully, we've talked about it before. It wasn't a full burn into geosynchronous orbit. It was just, we got it up kind of high and then it came back down. Which, you know, in all fairness, is actually Tesla.
Blue Origin. You mean Solar City? Or
no, you're right. Blue Origin, what's his name?
Yeah, Bezos.
Yeah, Bezos. You know, and it's like, I look at that company and I'm like, what they're doing is impressive. I don't want to diminish it just a little bit because what SpaceX is doing is more impressive. But what's exciting to me is that all of this in a decade, if not sooner, will be mundane. Like they won't be there. Yes. Blue Origins will have figured out how to do this with repeatability and success. And so will other companies. You know, this won't be an Elon Musk exclusive technology for the next half century. It'll be something that everybody does. And all of a sudden, a lot of these like crazy pipe dream things where they're now talking about, there's a company that is, they want I think we talked about them last week, or maybe I just read about them, but they're trying to send a lunar lander to the first private company trying to send a lunar lander to the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to get the Google prize money for doing that. Those sorts of things will become more affordable to send private landers, or the companies that are, they're planning on sending out a satellite to an asteroid to look at it, to see, hey, can we, looking to, with the intention of eventually going to the asteroid, mining it for its rare elements, and then bringing them back to Earth.
Which, by the way, is the same guy doing the XPRIZE, Peter Diamandis, who's also doing that company to take the, to try to mine asteroids.
I didn't know that. Yep. I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that sort of stuff, because it's like, you know, if we're going to strip a world of its natural resources and alter it in a way that it will never be able to, it'll never be the same ever again, yeah, let's do that to a barren rock out in the middle of outer space. It sounds like the right way to do it. So, and what SpaceX is doing with their stuff is, it's not tangential to what these other guys are doing. It's not somewhat related. It's foundational. It makes these other technologies possible, and not just economical, which is, you know, that's a cool and appropriate goal in and of itself to make money off this stuff, but it's good for the world. It's good for humanity, and it's exciting stuff. I swear I will be very disappointed, but not entirely surprised, if Elon Musk turns out to be a supervillain, because there's a part of me that thinks him being an actual superhero is just too good to be true. But I don't know. I get excited about this stuff. It's exciting. It's cool.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right. Tim Berners-Lee is at it again.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. He is unhappy with the way that the web is headed.
I feel like we should start by reminding people who Tim Berners-Lee is, because we've got a cheat sheet right in front of us.
Yeah, I'm going to get there. It's all good.
Okay.
So the reason why he is unhappy is that he feels like his original vision has been, what's the word, like taken over or
co-opted.
Yeah. Because you see what happened is when Tim Berners-Lee invented the web, he gave it to us as a gift. There were zero patents, zero copyrights, zero trademarks.
Yes.
It was free, open, do whatever you want. And it turns out that's what happened. And
which is pretty amazing.
On one hand, sweet. But on the other hand, it created opportunities for other companies to own certain parts of the web. So his original thing, like idea, was like, it's all decentralized. Nobody owns it, or you own your own stuff, and that's about it. That, as people know, is not true at all. Example, Facebook, they pretty much own all of your social networking information. Google owns all of your search related information. eBay owns auctions, and the list goes on and on. So, there's been kind of an effort to undo all of that. And so he's been working on a new project that's called Solid. It stands for Social Linked Data. And so the idea is that your data is stored in what he would call PODs, personal online data stores. He likes his acronyms. And so they're hosted wherever you would like them to be hosted. But then what happens is when essentially it's like it's your own data with an API. That's kind of how I understand it. So like, for example, if Facebook wanted to know who you were, they would go to your pod and get your information. If they wanted to know what you liked and what your, you know, I don't know, what movies you like, any like even status updates would be in your pod, and Facebook would simply access it. And that would be the same for Twitter and for Instagram with your photos. It would be a matter of saying, I'm putting my information into my pod, and then I'm simply giving permission to these other services to access it and kind of do what they want with it or not. It kind of reminds me a lot of the whole... remember like with the Web 2.0 days, it wasn't just about the graphics and stuff. It was about this whole idea of API and doing mashups and how do you combine three or four different sources of information to do something awesome. He kind of wants to get back to that, but have you own it? Because clearly what has happened is the Web 2.0 is dead for all intents and purposes. And places like Facebook and Google and even Apple to a degree, they own your information and they own it wholly. Especially things like Facebook don't want to share much of it unless you're doing like Facebook Connect, which I would say is like the Facebook version of pods.
Yeah.
Social information. We're like, oh yeah, you can sign in using Facebook. That's cool. You can access their friends and photos. Kind of like that, but again, think third party, obviously open source, that kind of stuff. And then there's even another group, I guess, called the Interplanetary File System, IPFS, not nearly as good as Tim's name is his convention. Yeah. Essentially,
Tim's a professional.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know. He started out with HTML. I don't know. That's just kind of...
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I don't know. It works, I guess. Anyways, they want to make the web work more like a BitTorrent, where there are multiple computers that supply only parts of the same page and parts of the information. So your pod may not even just be on a total on a server all by itself. It may be spread across multiple servers that are all bringing it together into one place, which are like that has obvious benefits as well. It's a lot more resilient and kind of reminds me of the blockchain as well in that regard, which I think is like the third part of this. Let's try to re-decentralize the web and everything and give the power back to the people and take it away from some of these bigger companies.
Right, because I mean, I feel like this is something worth breaking down a little bit for people who are familiar with all of these services, but don't necessarily know the machinations behind the scenes of how they work. And it's because it's like every Facebook profile page looks effectively the same, right? Yeah. And what the server does is it has two chunks of information, and it's going to give to your computer. One chunk of information is what all that framework looks like, the colors, the borders, which boxes go where. And then the other chunk of information is your personal information.
Right.
And all that information is just, it's abstract. It's just your name, your age, your posts, your tweets, your whatever. It's that long, it's a huge file. If you can think of it as a large file of just information, your information. And then the server, the computer, takes all the cool design stuff and takes all of your personal information, the pieces that it needs for this particular page, mashes it all up, and then it serves it to you as a finished product. So it's very hard for anybody, for a third party, to go into Facebook and get all of that information from Facebook because it's all intermixed together, and your computer can't tell the difference inherently between personal information and Facebook code, because it's all mixed together, and it makes it very difficult to kind of try to figure all that out. So what he's proposing is saying, look, instead of holding your personal information on Facebook server as its own little easy to read and understand file, we'll create a standard one that everybody knows what it looks like and where that information is stored. Everybody could create their own. They can keep it on their server. They could keep it on Facebook server. It doesn't matter. But the idea is then a company like face pods will come along and they'll create their own beautiful, stunning Facebook framework that's red and
or and that's dedicated to podcasters.
Exactly. And that will then have, it will go and it can grab that personal information from Facebook servers or from your personal server or from its own data stores and will build these websites. And what it does is it gives you the ability to have just your own personal information, easy to understand. You can put it anywhere. You can control it anywhere.
Right.
And
you can export it if needed. And yeah,
exactly.
Delete so it if you want.
Right.
There's an idea.
When what's fascinating about this to me is that it's like,
well, obviously, Facebook and Google and the incumbents have zero incentive to adopt this.
Well, is that true, though? Because I understand. Yeah, I see what you're saying. They have zero incentive to do it.
I mean, Google would, just because that's how they roll. And they would offer... what Google would say is... Sure, we'll do pods. We'll store all your information for you because we're good like that. And if you ever want to export it, that's totally fine. It will be in your pods format, and that's how I could see them roll. And they've got it in their own, and it's just an export option. And
right,
because Google's cool like that, they would do it. They also know you're not going anywhere else with their information.
Well, that's the thing is, I think Facebook.
Facebook's a little riskier because you could have another social network pop up and it just says, put on all my information and my friend connections. We're good to go.
And wait, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. But this kind of goes back to what my argument for Facebook has been for years, is that they're a great company and they're successful not because of the content that they own and curate. It's because of the types of technologies and platforms that they build. And ads is how they monetize it.
So they get to make all that great stuff.
Exactly. And I would sit there and go, I do think that they'd have to, I completely agree with you. They would keep their own kind of standard. Because what they would say is basically, I could see them say, look, yeah, host your pods anywhere or host them here. That's fine. We have other information like the social graph that has way more content than a pod could ever contain and all sorts of useful information. So that you still have a huge advantage of staying here with us in using our platform, because there's other things that an open source thing like pods never could handle. But at the same time, if you want your personal information to be on your encrypted server and all we get to do is go and access that, that's fine. You can do that too. Like I have a feeling that Facebook, I have a feeling that this is the sort of thing that would actually work. And, especially because it's like, you know, Facebook doesn't necessarily have to get on to, they don't have to pioneer it for this to be a cool thing. It would just have to be the Tim Berners-Lee, what's the name of that consortium that he's in charge of?
W3C or something.
Yeah, the World Wide Web Consortium. If they were to come up with this format and then, like, let's say, you know, I'm building an app that I want to allow people to set up a, a profile page on their app, but I don't want to build all that infrastructure for myself. Like all I'd have to do is go to GitHub, download a package that just is all it's going to do is it's going to, you basically just put in the web address of your pod, all of your personal information. And then it'll just fill out everything and do everything for me. As the app developer, there's a huge advantage there because it's now a standard format that everybody can use. And if you know, all it really requires is somebody to come along and say, we're going to build a server backend and some iOS and some Android packages that allow developers to easily implement it, and then just slowly let it grow and build, and even try to steal information from or steal or take or have the Facebook APIs to sort of auto-generate as much information as possible. Like I really do think that this is the sort of thing that people can get behind, and Facebook and Google would have an advantage, I think. There would be a, it would look like they're playing along and being good guys, even though they're like, yeah, but all the really valuable information, we still have that.
Yeah, I don't know. I could see they just ignore it, and the normal person doesn't care.
I mean, I, yeah, but that's how all web technologies work, man. I just, there's no, to me, there's no inherent, like, major, there's no inherent thing that, that you're sitting there going, oh, there's no way this will work because of X, Y, and Z that I can think of.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Outside of apathy. They would, people would have to cooperate, but.
Right. Apathy would be the killer.
Yep.
Agreed. As it always is.
Yeah. Their trick is to get in with some sort of killer app or, you know, existing or new. I mean, that's, right. That's how they gotta go about it.
I agree. Speaking of apathy.
Yeah.
So last week we talked about,
which one is it?
Right. So last week we talked about, the kind of the super long refresh cycles on your different Apple products and how
follow-up section, buddy. It's all right. It's okay. Do it anyways. So, okay. So for this show, we have a bunch of follow-up stories that have kind of been evolving over the last week or two. This is the first.
Do we? Okay, yeah, for sure. Okay, so yeah, basically what happened was last week we talked about how the Apple computers are, they're not refreshing them. There's like one that's relatively new. I think it's the one I'm actually using right now, which is quite nice, and I like it a lot. And I would totally take one.
Totally take one. Not
but
me.
So,
that was the latest announcement.
So there was a really interesting article on Mac 360 that was asking the question, what's the last Mac you'll ever buy? And they proposed this sort of this idea that inevitably we will all buy the last Mac that we ever buy. And wait, especially if you're an Apple user, if you're in the Apple,
okay,
Apple
all right.
ecosystem.
Say that. Inevitably we will all buy the last Mac we will ever buy?
Yeah, so like, you know, eventually you'll die and what's the last Mac you bought before you died? And but their point in this article is saying that that will actually come long before you die, that eventually you will buy a Mac that is good enough and will just carry you forward, and most of your continual upgraded computing that keeps up with the pace of change will come in the form of iPads or iPhones or Apple Watches, whatever. That your high-end Macs, for most people, we are within 5 to 10 years of every Apple customer, that the Mac they buy within that 5 to 10 period will be like the last Mac they ever buy, outside of super dedicated professionals that need something even beyond that. But even then, it's kind of like a weird, well, what would you need? What are you talking about? Because they're saying iPads are going to get so good that if you need high-end graphics power, iPads will be able to handle it. If you need portability, iPhones will be able to handle it. Everything you could possibly want to do. So this all kind of goes into this larger discussion that we had last week of why isn't Apple refreshing their... Why is a company that's the most valuable company on Earth with hundreds of billions of dollars of cash stackpiled
right.
seem to be ignoring this rather large and important business sector? And what Mac 360 is trying to, they're trying to make the argument of they're ignoring it because it's not necessary. People just don't need this anymore. They don't need an ever increasing.
Like, it's good enough type of thing, maybe? Or
yeah, I think that's what they're trying to say is. Yeah. Well, and that's the part that I always come back to is it's like, yeah, Macs are good enough for everything but the cutting edge. But today's cutting edge is tomorrow's mundane. And tomorrow's cutting edge is completely incompatible with today's mundane. And it's like, Apple, your computers have become mundane. And so I guess their argument, and this would be, well, yeah, but the iPads will be able to keep up with the cutting edge. And Because they are looking at them as iPad Pros are full-blown computers. They're incredibly powerful, incredibly light mobile laptops. And which, you know, there's some validity to. it's not a ridiculous argument to make. But then I always come back to, well, then what's the point of the Mac lineup at all? Is it just to have an operating system that allows root access so that you can write code, you can write applications on it? Which seems to me at this point that's the entire point of, you know, there
and multitasking as far multiple windows. Come on.
Right. I know.
I can do the count again this week if you want. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 things open. 2 tabs in one of them. Let's see, how many different programs? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different programs open at the moment.
Which I get, but you also have a 27-inch 5K monitor to look at all that stuff with.
Not at the moment. I'm on my Mac, dude. Come on.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
It's only 21 inches, 0.5.
Oh, how can you even see?
You know, I struggle.
I'll bet it's just HD,
isn't it? I'm squinting, pathetic, to be honest.
Pathetic HD.
Yeah, it's not even Retina.
But, yeah, I look at this, I look at what Apple's doing, and
to also just be clear, like, I'm running everything. I'm not upset right now.
Yeah.
And going, oh, this is so unworkable. I wish I could do these other things as well. You know what I mean? So
My Mac Mini is great, and I don't see any reason. I don't see any slowdown from it outside of high-end graphic applications. And by high-end graphic applications, I mean low to medium-end graphic applications. Because my Mac Mini has a grip of RAM and an i7 processor. Like, it can tear through pretty much anything, but it has an integrated graphics card. So it can tear through pretty much anything except graphic applications.
Remember the days when, like, Macs were like, it's all about graphics and not crunchy numbers?
I know. Man. It's a weird switch. It's funny. I've been learning how to use the Sprite Kit framework for Apple, which is how a lot of 2D games are made. And one of the things they recommend you do is to don't use the simulator on your computer, because it's not optimized for that, and sometimes your Macs can get a little revved up trying to do it. So they're like plug in your phone and simulate it on your phone. Which I was like, okay, cool, but I'm not going to. I'm going to use the simulator because I'm not going to have my phone there. So I ran it the first time, and like 10 seconds later, the fans kicked on my Mac Mini. Which the fan never kicks on my Mac Mini. And I was like, that's a little disconcerting. So I picked up my Mac Mini. The bottom of it felt like it was going to melt. It was so hot. I immediately, like, turned everything off. I put a fan on it. I was like, jeez, okay. Never mind. I'll take this seriously. My Mac can't do graphics. But my point in all of that is, it's like, I guess it comes back to the whole today's cutting edge is tomorrow's mundane. Like, right now, virtual reality and augmented reality are cutting edge. Tomorrow they're going to be mundane. So is Apple just going to sit there and go like, well, no, just use your iPad. Like, well, yeah, but where are you going to develop for it? I don't know. I feel like something else is going on. Not Apple's being lazy, not Apple's just going, like, doesn't know what's happening around them. I really do feel like Apple is sitting there saying, look, we're kind of on the cusp of a paradigm shift that we think is occurring, and we're not going to invest a lot of money and energy in pushing the old paradigm forward. We're not going to put a lot of money and time saying, no, we're going to keep building up the Macs. No, we're going to let it kind of get to a ridiculous level. And then all of a sudden, we're going to come out with something that is that's going to be part of the next paradigm. Not even we're going to introduce it, but just say, look, the mobile world is the world, and we're leaving traditional computers behind. And which I still think, I don't know. I keep coming back to an open source version of iOS Linux sort of thing. Something where Apple goes, we just don't sell hard. We don't sell this kind of hardware anymore. We only sell mobile devices and large, high power.
A lot of money off of PCs. So.
I know. But it's a transition where I could see them thinking in 20 years, like, we need an incredibly stable internal operating system. And so we will, in 20 years, their goal would be, we need our operating system to be stable, but to work. Like, we'll only build hardware internally. We'll only do our own things internally. And maybe we'll let other people have that software just as kind of a whatever, we don't need it. I don't know. I don't know what's going on, man. I can't make any sense of it, James. It's a crazy mixed up world.
It's okay. But it can remain a crazy mixed up world. Also crazy mixed up. Nah, it's not crazy mixed up. It's kind of awesome. We're going to continue down this series of following up from previous stories. So as we talked about last week, Instagram has copied Snapchat and their stories format. And I like this title here. I think they did a good job with it. It says that Instagram castrated Snapchat like Facebook neutered Twitter. It's like they recently were at a pet place or something.
Yeah.
But the argument, which I thought is good, is they go, look, Instagram stories doesn't have to be amazing. It just has to be good enough because they already have the audience. It has a prominent placement. All they have to do is essentially stop people from joining Snapchat to look at the stories and to use them to just go, oh, I'll just use Instagram. Yeah. And it'll just cut them off at the knees, which they're like, that's kind of what happened with Twitter when Facebook decided to implement the subscribe option inside of Facebook, where it's like, no, you don't have to be friends. You don't have to reciprocate. You can just have people subscribe to your updates. So if you're already on Facebook, cool. You're
right.
Because
the worst thing that would happen for Facebook would be you'd go and sign up with, I might be contradicting myself. What I said earlier, the worst thing for them is that you'd go and sign up for one of these other services, because the hardest thing for a lot of people to do is to put in their email and their new password, which just drives people crazy. But once you've done it, once you've gotten over that leap, once you're subscribed once you have a login to Twitter, then it becomes way easier for most people to start using it and becoming really active on it. And so if they can just keep you from ever downloading Snapchat, then they've won. They don't actually have to be better than Snapchat. Snapchat can do better. They just have to... Snapchat can be way better. But if Instagram meets the lowest...
Yeah.
If it's going, if it's above the lowest bar and just stops people from being like, oh, I have to try out Snapchat, then mission accomplished. They'll stay here.
Yeah. And so, and it seems to be working, because there's another story that says that there are a bunch of media companies like CNN, Food Network, People, Comedy Central, Cosmopolitan, and Tastemade that are all trying out Instagram stories. Now, those may sound familiar because those are the exact same ones that also have their own special channels on Snapchat.
Interesting.
And so so they're just like, yeah, they're trying them all out, and because they already have a presence on Instagram. And it's going to be one of those things where it's like, well, you want those stories and that information, you can get them on Instagram now too. No reason to sign up for Snapchat to get those.
Which, if we are right, and I think we are, that Snapchat looks at itself as a media company, well, that's a horrible problem for Snapchat, because now you don't have exclusive content. They created a format that nobody else had. Therefore, any content created for it was inherently exclusive. They didn't have to write, they didn't have to negotiate with these guys and say, no, your content will be exclusive to Snapchat. Where else would you put it? You can only put it on Snapchat because we're the only ones with this format.
I wonder if this is going to be one of those where it was like, they didn't trademark it or do what they needed to do to protect it. And it sounds like even if they did, Instagram and their lawyers would have figured out a way to say, actually, no, it's not trademarkable. But it was one of those where they went, oh, shoot.
Yeah. Or I'll bet
or
it's this.
Or even just put in, like you said, just put in exclusivity rights. Like they didn't do that. And because at the time they're like, why? Yeah, you're the only one. And they wasn't even on the radar that someone was going to copy them and just come out and say, yeah, we totally copied you. It's a great idea. And right. And
so, yeah. Well, it's so brilliant. It's such a brilliant gambit by Facebook. And Mark Zuckerberg is notoriously aggressive about this sort of thing. Where, like, when Google came out, we did the story where Google came out with their Google Plus, the competitor with Facebook, and Facebook was on high alert for months. People were working on Saturdays and Sundays. Like, they were just, Facebook was churning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and Google was working 40 hours a week. and they lost. And it's not surprising because Facebook was like, anything that they have that could possibly be better that it makes their platform better than ours, let's integrate it so fast that nobody has a reason to even go and try Google Plus. And I see it. I bet what's going on here is, or I could see it be one of those things here where Facebook is like, look, it doesn't matter if we're stealing from them. It doesn't matter if they're going to sue us and it's going to cost us hundreds of millions of dollars. It's so much more important that they don't get our users that we're willing to spend that money. And if it takes them, if they sue us, it could take 2-3 years for the courts to finally tell us we have to stop.
I wonder but how long it'll take before Facebook starts getting into antitrust issues. That's going to be interesting. I'm sure they like are small ones, but you know, to like the Microsoft level, where it's like, ooh, okay, we got to be a little more careful here, because that could be the kind of thing where if they're doing anti-competitive stuff like that, and that could get them in the bigger long-term trouble, but
right. They're so aggressive. I think they will, if they keep getting bigger and they keep succeeding at these sorts of things, I think they'll go further and further down that road until the government actually steps in and say, yo, you gotta stop. I don't think they'll have an internal brake mechanism.
Yeah. To say, oh, no, let's I stop totally being. Agree.
And yeah, so I just sit there and I go that, yeah, it's, oh man, it's smart. It's real smart.
It is smart. But you know what's not smart?
What's not smart?
Chip card readers. Yay!
Yay!
Another follow-up story. So, good news. It's going to get faster.
Yeah.
But it's taking a long time. There was a cool article in the Wall Street Journal that was like, they're improving it, but you know what? Mobile payments are still the best of all of them. And so here is my call to action. Okay.
Yeah.
So the next time, and this is like for everybody, the next time you're checking out, if it's not obvious that you can use your phone, you should ask, can I pay with my phone? Because what's happening is a bunch of the retailers are like, they're trying to phase in the different changes. And so because of the whole fraud thing, they got the chip card. So they're focusing on that, which, you know, some of the fun stuff about it is they're supposed to require a PIN, even if it's a credit card, and like none of them do. And
right.
Like, so, okay. And they still do a signature thing, which is kind of a joke. We all know it and is not required with the chip and PIN setup.
And that's so weird. So we didn't know that.
Yeah, so we're still living in this weird halfway world. And they say a lot of them with the new terminals, they will have NFC built into them. I noticed the Verifone ones don't, and there's a lot of them up here, which is kind of lame. But anyways, a lot of them will have or do have the NFC option. They just don't turn them on right now because they're busy trying to figure out the whole chip card thing. And so, right. And so they're trying to work on that, and the EMV companies are working on trying to get it faster. So like, so all that to say, like, things will get better and they will start to turn those things on. So now is the time to be asking to pay with your phone to give that feedback to stores to let them know, no, like, customers want to do this. So when you're in a store and it's not obvious that you can pay with your phone, you should ask, can I pay with my phone? To which they will say no. And then you get to respond with, oh, I would like to request this feature, please, or this feature.
I like that.
And
I like that.
Just to send, just to send the feedback. So,
like, yeah, because honestly, it's my preference. I'd rather.
And it's more secure. That's because because the whole thing about the chip is that it sends it's a one-time secure number through the system,
right?
Which is exactly what all the phones do as well. They're just doing it on the phone instead of in the card. And then, and they are faster, by the way, and they timed it out, and it's twice as slow to use the pin or the chip, assuming you get it right the first time, which, like, is sometimes rare.
Right.
And then, but then they were saying the other nice part about the pin is that, in theory, like, you can type in the number, which someone could learn if they wanted, I suppose. Whereas with the phone, it uses the authentication of your thumbprint, which is a little bit harder to duplicate.
Right.
And so, in that sense, it's definitely more secure. Then you get the instant notifications if it's been used and all that other fun stuff. So, anyways, that's my call to action. Ask, can I pay with my phone? And when they say no, ask, I would like to request this feature, please. So there you go.
That's cool. I will do that.
There you go. And final follow-up story for the week before we get back to newish stuff is that there was, I don't know, a hackathon, kind of. I don't know if that's what it is. Yeah. It was the DEF CON Hacker Conference. It was a hackathon. Excellent.
Yeah, in the traditional sense of the word,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. And so this is kind of a follow-up on the whole smart home thing. And what they found is that 75% of Bluetooth smart locks can be hacked.
Mm.
Not great. Do you want to know which one is in the 25% group?
Is the one that you have?
It is August.
Yes.
Boom.
That's awesome.
They do it. There's
is that because there's only four?
No, there's like 12 of them.
Oh, okay. I was like, that's a rather round number, but okay. It's
yeah. So Quickset makes one in August, and then some other tiny other ones that no one really cares about. They do say, though, there is some vulnerability to it.
Sledgehammers?
yeah, well, there's that, too. But it's not like... Well, they were saying, like, for some of them... Oh, I take that back. There are 16 of them that they tested. So they were saying that for some of them... it's like either the code that you're sending back and forth, like, is unencrypted. It's just like, whatever.
Oh my gosh. That can't be true. Can't be true.
I wish it was.
It's so annoying because it's so easy to implement it nowadays. Like,
four locks were transmitting their password in plain text.
Of course they are. That is just
unexcusable. Let's see here. And two of them. This is Quick Lock, by the way. They sent the password twice, just in case you didn't get the first time.
What? You know, sometimes I think to myself, like, I'll get mired in, like, I want to build a thing, but I start to think about, like, how do you do it securely so that these people's personal information isn't like abused, and I'll get kind of quagmired in, like, you know, I don't know exactly how to do this, and it's a little hard, and no, I won't worry about it. It's too much effort. I gotta abandon that notion. I gotta just forget about security. That's their problem, not mine. Do it the easiest way possible. I can't believe these are your people. You are selling home locks to people.
Security. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
There was another one where it was encrypted, but all they had to do was send the encrypted password back, and it worked.
Ha, 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 So, oh gosh, they didn't even.
There was another one. They used their own proprietary one, which he's like, we know about these. These all roll your own ones. So they tried a fuzzing attack, so it sends random data to the lock. Totally worked. What that happens is it entered an error state and unlocked.
Oh, that, you know, that makes sense. It's a fail safe because a fail. Well, it's a weird form of fail safe. It's the if it fails, we don't want people to be locked in or out of their house, so it unlocks if it fails. But yeah, but that's really dumb. It's got.
And then let's see. Then there's
these are security features. It's blowing my mind, man.
Yeah. So, anyways, not great. And yes, you can always either take a hammer or just break a window. It might be easier.
That's the problem here, James. That's the problem here, James. Is that at this point using a hammer wouldn't be easier on these other ones?
Very true. But yeah. Anyways, so there you go. Smart locks. Think twice.
I didn't grab the article, but there was a there's a vulnerability with, I think it's Volvo. You know what? If they sue us, it's fine. That's a good sign. We're big enough to get sued. But Volvo, they have their key fobs are all high tech now, and they have some major like wireless vulnerabilities. It's just, man, this security stuff. I can understand why people.
That's the internet. Ignore it. Problem.
Yeah, I can understand why people ignore it because it's complicated and it's obscure and it's hard to understand. But it's like you really need to get it through people's head that it's like A, it's possible, and B, it's important. You know, and because I think that's the sort of the feeling that sometimes people get is like, well, it must not be possible because it's poorly implemented by so many people. But if we have this expectation that, no, we're not going to buy anything or use any product unless it's implemented well, then if we can get people on that page that, no, this is important, it has to be a priority, then everybody can do it.
What if we ever get to point where it's got some sort of like FCC regulation type of thing? Where, like, if you have any sort of security, it needs to go through an approval process. I don't know. I mean, that would be another. That would be the.
You know, honestly,
free market way of handling the problem.
I'm gonna say, but you know what would be really smart? If you were a security firm and you spent a lot of money, basically saying we're a for profit
authenticate you.
Regulation. Yeah, we authenticated. Does your smart lock have the Furlough Bros seal of security approval?
Right. Like the Verisign.
We might have to come up with
websites and yeah.
Exactly. We might have to come up with a better name than that.
I don't see a problem.
You know what? It says what it says and it gets the message across. That's the important part.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's, you know, it's one of the, yeah, I agree.
We have, like,
I
think some it would sort of be security rating system. Yeah.
Right.
That'd be interesting. Like a five stars or something.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know how many stars there are. It's so encrypted.
Yes, exactly. 256 bits worth of stars.
Yeah.
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 I don't know. It's interesting. Jeez, I can't believe that.
There you go.
Jeez. Fail safe.
So there's some follow-ups.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thanks for bringing us that. So this is kind of a follow-up from a story from years ago. So Apple has started doing public betas of all their operating systems, which is kind of weird because they used to not do that and for a long time. And what was really interesting to me was that for years, we've known what the iPhones were going to be before they came out because there were leaks and from China or from wherever, and because somebody left them in a bar. But the software was still very much an enigma because you'd get at the Worldwide Developers Conference, they would release the software, but nobody was allowed to download it and use it unless you were a developer. And so for most people who were excited about Apple, the first time they really got to use the new operating system would be the day that the new hardware launched.
Right.
And it just kind of kept an enigma on the whole thing and made it more exciting and really focused a lot of even more energy on the launch day, where people could finally try out the new operating system and see all the new features. But they don't do that anymore. And they started this new public beta where anybody can download the operating system. And they didn't really say why. There were theories going around like, A, people just became developers. It wasn't a big stop there, or there was hacked versions of it that could easily download. It was so easy for anybody who wanted to do it that it was one step removed. And a lot of times people got even worse versions of it because they were doing it kind of a weird backwards way. So Apple just did, they already had this system in place for developers to get the betas. So it wasn't like they had to build a new infrastructure for it. All they had to do was say, look, this is a beta. You can use it, but just, you know.
It's a beta.
We're not going to support it like it's an actual offer.
I hear the latest beta is fairly stable if you're...
That's, you know, I'm feeling the Jones. I'm actually... I got to finish this book. Okay, you've convinced me. I got to finish this app book that I'm building for SpriteKit, because it's all... The whole book is written in Swift 1.2. And in order to, and it's pretty compatible with Swift 2. It works pretty well. I've only had to make a few changes, but the shift from Swift 2 to Swift 3, you're now so far removed that I don't think I could finish this book. And I really want to finish this book before I do that. But I'm interested in getting the beta before. Of course, it might take me till September, in which case we'll have a new iPhone. Anyways, so finally this last week, they finally talked about why they came out with the public betas and what spurred that on. And turns out that when they launched Apple Maps, it was a pretty big disaster. It was a real blight on the company. They fired Scott Forstall over it, got rid of him, which I still think that was... I think that might have been the 100-pound sack that broke the camel's back, but I think Johnny Ives didn't like him and was looking for, they were looking for a way to put Johnny Ives in charge of Scott Forstall's domain. But
I would rather get rid of Eddie than Scott, but anyways, that's just me.
No, you know what? Eddie Q doesn't. I feel like
he's not a threat.
He's not good enough to be scary. I feel like Eddie Q doesn't necessarily make things great, but he also doesn't make things awful. Whereas occasionally Scott Forstall would make things awful.
All right.
Let's make the podcasting app just terrible, but it'll have this cool reel-to-reel animation. We're like, what is going on? So Eddie Q and they finally talked about it this week, and they were like, yeah, once Apple Maps came out, like, they had a big emergency meeting after they fired Scott. Like, what do we do? Because there was a lot of talk about just turning back on Google Maps as the primary API and being like, oops, sorry guys, that's a huge mistake. You were right. And what Apple eventually decided was, they said, look, we need to own the Maps technology because we're building a car and we want to own this part of the infrastructure, and we need this. This is important that we have it. And so we're going to suffer the consequences of it and just make do. But the other thing that they realized was that there was an inherent problem that they hadn't recognized before, which was their beta testers all tend to be part of a particular club. People who are really into Apple, either because they work at Apple or because they're developers living in the Bay Area. And I remember when Apple Maps first came out, and I kept making the comment, like, I don't understand what everybody's saying about Apple Maps. It seems fine to me. It works great. Like, it's as good as Google Maps. Well, it turns out it's because it was in the Bay Area where all the beta testers live.
Awesome.
If you were anywhere else in the world, it was horrible, which I wasn't aware of it because I lived in the Bay Area. Talking to my girlfriend who was living in Portland at the time, I guess it was it was real bad. Like it was interesting. It was real bad. And so Apple is finally like, they've come back a long way with Apple Maps. People are telling them, you know, people are, the word on the street is, you know, it's okay, you can go back to it. Google Maps is still better. It's got a couple of features that I think make it a little more usable, especially in big cities. But on the whole, Apple Maps is as good. You know, it's above the lowest bar for most people. But what they realized was that there are going to be technologies that they are pushing out that just require more people looking at it, more people beta testing it, more people getting into it and saying, hey, we have a potential issue here. And so that was what spurred on the public beta tests for iOS. It's just a way of getting more data from more people to look at what's going on in the world. And that was their big conclusion, was that we have to be a little less insular about everything we're doing. Now, they do talk about, like, in contrast to that, why don't you talk about all these cool R&D projects that you're clearly working on, you're spending billions and billions of dollars on? And ABQ responded with, look, we don't think it's impressive to point out a problem and then say, we're working on it. What we think is impressive is saying, hey, look, we solved a problem. And it goes, so we just wait until we've solved the problem before we tell the world what we did. And whereas companies like Google are like, hey, this is a problem, watch us try to solve it. Which I'm like, there's a part of me that's like, I get it. I get where they're coming from. At the same time, I really like watching Google solve problems, so I'm not exactly sure what's going on here. Oh, what's the problem again? But it's just a... It's, you know, I like the fact that at least they're couching it in terms of I don't know. I like how they couched it. It's good. I like both companies. I'd be disappointed if we didn't have both of them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Okay, interesting. I didn't know that. That's good to know. That's how they came up with it. Yeah, I am no longer tempted to try, I'm no longer at that phase of my life where I'm tempted to download a beta and totally go after it and see what happens. But
yeah,
I mean, I'm a little tempted, but I'm not like, oh, I'm totally going to do it.
We're a month out from the next iPhone, so it's got to be pretty stable at this point.
Yeah, you know, probably
September 9th. Put it on your calendars.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, news came out this week that Facebook is now blocking ad blockers on their site. They really want to get paid for those ads, which in some ways is another follow-up story. It's all right. Yeah. And, And so they're like, yep, we want to be able to show you those ads, and so we're going to make them look like all the other stuff on Facebook so that, so that the ads are there. So, sorry. And
so this goes back to just a kind of – so this is – I said this on purpose earlier. So what they used to do was inside the code, they would clearly denote that – ads were ads, which made it really easy for ad blocker to come in and say, okay, anything that is marked as an ad, just hide it from the screen. And whether it's an ad in the sidebar or an ad in your news feed. So if you were using ad blocker plus, you weren't getting any of those ads because they were all very clearly labeled that. And Facebook on the back end, they went through and changed it so that nothing is clearly denoted as an ad. And it all kind of, from your computer's perspective, it all kind of looks like just your friend's content. You know, you, the reader, might be able to tell easily that it's an ad, but your computer can't.
Right, right, exactly. So, that, you know, it's kind of a big deal. And then later in the week, there was more news that Adblock Plus had already defeated Facebook's new ad blocking restrictions. And, both of them, let's see here, Facebook had their thing, Adblock Plus came out with a post that was like, we're very disappointed, but we beat you.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. I think it was like literally 24 hours later, Facebook came out with a post saying, "We're very disappointed in AdBlock Plus, and we have rewritten the code to nullify their nullification of our nullification."
Yeah. The best part of this story has been the moral what's the word? The moral down looking at the other company. Oh, you guys, you're being so bad to the users. The users are our primary concern. And then the other company, oh, you're treating those users like garbage. You're the worst.
Yeah, Facebook's like, you're destroying the user experience the way that it was intended for them to enjoy it. And it's like, they're both disappointed. It's so funny. And then AdBlock Plus is, you are not allowing users the right to choose what they do and do not want to see on your website. And you're violating their personal privacy because you're sharing information kind of with third party advertisers. And we don't endorse that. And yeah, dude, let the games begin.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Did
I love
say,
it.
I mean, Facebook has a couple of advantages. Probably better engineers and more of them at the very least. For them, it's just they update the server and it's updated. Whereas with AdBlock, they literally have to do a new download and customers have to actually go and download it. So they're like, AdBlock probably will not win this war, per se, but it's fun to watch.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is the important thing, is that I think Facebook is very aware that there is a limit to how many commercials they can put into Facebook and before they start to diminish the user experience. And they're like, that's a big priority for them right now. And I honestly think that that's the biggest competitive advantage that Facebook has, which is they're building Facebook in such a way that it's not, their ads aren't annoying.
That's what they, most people, their argument. They're like, they're getting rid of relevant ads that people like. It's like, really?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. I know you say really, but like at the same time, like, I kind of
like the sidebar.
On my argument,
there's
I don't like sidebar ads.
Promoted posts and the sidebar ads.
Yeah,
and that's what they're getting.
I actually don't mind the. Well, see, that's not entirely true. The ad blocker would go through and get rid of the promoted posts as well. Cool. And Facebook is actually one of their things was, they're like, look, you can't tell what's an ad or not anymore. So ad blocker is erring on the side of get rid of too much, right, as opposed to too little. Make sure you get all the ads. And so Facebook was saying they're hiding actual user content. They're hiding your
friends'
posts.
Which you would never know because Facebook doesn't put them in any normal order.
Right. And maybe I don't like my friends. Maybe I'm just friends with them because of, you know, social expectations. Yeah. Maybe I don't like them and this is exactly what I wanted. That actually would be really funny if you could, because I know that you can report ads to AdBlock. That's how they kind of figure out where ads are, and they build up their database of what ads to block. That would be really funny to just pick a friend and report all of their posts as ads, or so that they get blocked on all AdBlock users.
I know, that's a horrible prank.
I know, that would be. Oh my gosh, that'd actually be really funny.
That would be like, but if you were to do. Oh, that strikes me as like a Colin Schumer, or you know the ones where they did the fox howling at the moon shirt on Amazon. Like, we want this one.
Yeah, exactly.
One. Everyone buy it and leave awesome comment reviews.
Exactly.
Something that's like that. You could have that hilarious. Be the same one where it's like, okay, we're going after this public figure. Let's do this.
That's That'd be really funny.
That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah, so I don't know. I've said for years, I don't mind good advertising. I mind bad advertising. You hear that, NBC? You hear what we're saying? We don't like bad advertising
altogether. Twitter is so much better for the Olympics. Just want to put it out there. That's if you want to enjoy them,
NBC,
use Twitter. Do not watch them.
Okay. Fair enough. That is good advice. So this is kind of an interesting follow-up to the future. So LG is quadrupling down on their headphone jack. That's not to say that they are. Yeah, that's not to say that they're building a phone with four headphone jacks. What they are building is a phone that has four digital to analog converters into it, into the headphone jack. And the reason why you do that is because it allows you to take really high grade, like high sampled music, and produce a really, really, really great analog sound for your headphones or for your audio output in general. So there is diminishing returns on how many digital to analog converters you use, for because what happens is each digital analog converter focuses on different frequency ranges, whether it's your super low frequencies to your high frequencies that correspond to your subs and your woofers and everything. And so they're creating this really great signal that has a great audio output for your headphone being jacked in. And the reason why this is worth mentioning at all is because Apple's getting rid of the headphone jack in a month with the next iPhone. And LG is seeing this as an opportunity to be like, look, if you really like having great headphones, you can just plug it into an LG phone and it's going to sound
That's a great idea.
And
because that's definitely...
It really is.
...going to attract. And so make it attractive.
Exactly. And I it's funny to me because I'm like, I wonder if this is going to go the way of Flash, where Apple came out and said we're not going to support Flash on the iPhone, and all of the like Android phone makers came out and said our phones not only can support Flash, but it supports it the best. Flash is so good. Everybody wants Flash. Who could imagine getting rid of Flash? And then like 3 years later, they were like, okay, Flash is terrible. We're not gonna support Flash.
Turns out this is a horrible mistake.
Yeah. And it feels like every week there's another article that's just like, oh yeah, okay, so you know how we told you last week that Flash is officially dead? Well, it's deader this week. And I wonder if that's the way this is gonna go, where it's just like you're gonna see a bunch of companies just jump into the mix, and Samsung and LG and HTC and everybody's gonna jump in and be like, we got the best audio output headphone jack, and then in like 2 years everybody's gonna be like, look, nobody wants a headphone jack, it turns out. They all want this cool, they want Bluetooth headphones, or they want a USB
headphones.
Or they
headphones, have a standalone
and,
player.
Yeah, we were wrong. Yeah, exactly. And which I think is, I don't know, that's my gut, which is what's going to happen.
I get it. And remember, there were individuals, too, who were indignant about the fact that Apple didn't have Flash. So at least a couple of years, it's gonna make a difference. They'll see a bump. I mean, it won't be huge, but
right.
See a bump.
And by the way, this is going to be my, I agree, this is going to be my argument starting September 10th, so just be prepared for it. If you don't like the fact that Apple doesn't have a headphone jack, go get the LG, like, new phone. There are great Android phones that has a high-quality operating system, are high-performance, generally cost less, and have headphone jacks. Please, don't get, like, we don't care. You're wrong, and eventually you'll own a phone without a headphone jack. And you'll be happier about it, which is going to be really mind-blowing for you, I know. But just don't worry about it now if you can't keep up. It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. Nice. And then my last story that I want to throw out there is, so Amazon has introduced one-click food purchases inside of Prime Video shows.
Video shows.
And I was like,
interesting.
Yeah. At first I was like, I don't know about this. And then I read about it. This is brilliant. It's a cooking show.
Oh.
And when things pop up on the cooking show, you can just be like, oh, that looks really good. And with one click, you can purchase it.
We've talked like that's how it should have been for a long time.
I know. It's like, this is where it's like, if you're in Suicide Squad and you see the dude throw his Samsung tablet up on the window and show you stuff with his Samsung phone, there should just be a little button that you can be like, I want that thing. Boop. Press it. And it'll be delivered directly to you. One button. This is like the first time we're seeing this. I think there's going to be an obnoxious wave of advertising like this. And honestly, this is how the how NBC should be doing them. They should be doing a picture-in-picture where they go to their commercial makers and say, look, you're going to get three quarters of the screen. The other quarter is going to be the volleyball game. And we're going to, and you can, you get all the audio, you get to take over the entire, you get everything except we're going to do picture in picture for that 30 seconds or minute that you have. We're going to keep people watching because otherwise they're going to lose everybody to Twitter inevitably. But
if only NBC wasn't smart.
Yeah. You know what the worst part is? I think that there's a lot of people at NBC that are that smart and do realize it. And there's a lot of old guys that are like, no, we can fight this.
Something. Okay, I want to finish it off with just one fast, crazy story. Swedes are crazy, just so you know. So
that's awesome. Yeah.
So they have this system. Oh, it's so awesome. Where it takes a radar and it measures your speed, and it's just, you know, fixed on the road, that kind of thing. And if you are speeding, they don't just flash a little sign at you and say, slow down. No way. Instead, they have, I wouldn't call it a speed bump. It's more like a speed hole that opens up in the ground. And
put a pothole, a mechanical pothole.
Yes. That if you're going the speed limit, no big deal. No pothole, roll along. If you're speeding, oh, there's a pothole. And I get the sense that, like, it changes size based on your speed, which would be awesome. Yeah. But yeah, dude, that's just sweet. Just a little mechanical pothole to slow you down. I love it.
That's really funny. That's, oh my gosh. I wonder how long term they, because that's a lot of movement that they'll be doing.
True.
But there's a reliability question there, but it's pretty clever. Kind of like it.
Yeah.
And as a guy who at my age, I don't mind going the speed limit, you know, from time to time. I would appreciate that because I hate going over speed bumps. Even when I'm going slowly. So I would get rewarded for going the speed limit. You know what? That would incentivize me. I get that. Yeah. I like it.
So anyways, there you go. Thanks everybody for listening to us. And thanks for listening to, oh my gosh, for listening to us. You are listening to, I got this, episode 255. And if you want to check out all the show notes for that, you just go to furloughbros.com/255. If you don't want to go there and you just like them sent directly to you, you can sign up on furloughbros.com and we'll just email them to you every week, like clockwork. And then finally, like was mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, kind of awkwardly by Matthew, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. And so if you would also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels. You could be a fanboy, a nerd, a junkie, and a maven. Super awesome. You should check it out. All right, I am James Furlough, and my insane bolting brother is Matthew Furlough, and so we will talk next time.